Our next speaker is Helen Hudson.
So, the question that all of these talks are addressing, I guess, in one way or another, is that of how do we organize from an anti-oppression perspective. And the first thing I thought when I heard that is, in order to really address this and address this in a way that people would understand where I was coming from, I thought I should back up a little bit and talk about my own involvement in getting involved in trying to do just that. It's been a relatively recent process in the grand scheme of things. My parents are immigrants. We settled here in Ottawa just as I was about to start grade 9, and I eventually got involved in the environmental movement here in Ottawa. So just for a short hand, for context and for me to make this relevant here, how many people here are from Ontario? And how many people are from Ottawa? Okay. So, that was in 1988, I guess. And that's sort of when I first started getting involved in organizing and asking myself some of the questions that I'm sure people in this room ask themselves every day or on a fairly frequent basis. What are the most effective ways of organizing? What are we trying to do? How can we make our means and our ends fit together? Eventually, I went away to university in Guelph. And was involved and have been since then until fairly recently in mostly campus-based organizing, for better or for worse. I can attest pretty directly to the fact that campus-based organizing is a pretty interesting form of organizing where issues of oppression and how they play into organizing are going to, you know, rear their heads on a daily basis. It's a really privileged environment in terms of class, and with that in terms of race, you know, and everything else that could be a speech in and of itself. And it wasn't in the city where I was, in Guelph, which is a fairly small university-based town, it wasn't until Harris came to power that bubble was burst. And I found that there was a shift almost immediately within the first couple of months of Mike Harris being in power and all that first wave of legislation that was pushed through, that people sort of said, oh my God, this affects us. The struggle is now real. It's on a day-to-day basis. People we know are directly affected. Where, you know, not to universalize it too much, of course, people were affected in one way or another before, but in a small town, campus-based context, the sort of things that people were fighting for, the sort of struggles that people were organizing around, weren't nearly as day-to-day as they would be, you know, in a lot of other places where people struggle. So up until that point, you know, one could be involved in the Women's Center, one could be involved in an anti-racist collective, one could be fighting for lower tuition, and those struggles could be fairly separate. And the questions of how to deal with oppression within organizing could be fairly delinked from each other and fairly academic, as most things at the university can. So I moved to Montreal about 3 years ago. By that point, Harris had been in power for a pretty long time, and you know, in terms of anti-globalization types of things, I feel like in Eastern Canada, Northeastern United States, there's starting to be a growing movement, which, you know, you guys are all part of one way or another, trying to take the discourse from anti-globalization to anti-capital, and trying to draw the links between sort of, you know, helping those poor, impoverished people in other countries who are affected by globalization to realizing that on many, many levels, which again could be a speech in and of itself, those things are happening in our very own communities as well. So that's, you know, now I'm involved in the groups that I mentioned in my introduction. I've been involved in CLAC as well. It's my day job. I work for one of the PERGs in Montreal. So that's where I'm coming from. So now we come to the question, how do we organize from an anti-oppression perspective? Well, in order to answer that question, we have to be clear on what oppression is, and I would very much echo some of the things that Oscar had been saying, so I won't repeat them exactly. But one thing I did want to comment on is I'm noticing more and more that we don't really have a clear consensus within the movement or movements represented in this room at the consulta this weekend or organizing around the G8 on what oppression is. And I can follow my own notes here. And not too long ago, something struck me about exactly what what one of the major differences is. And this is going to give away my own academic tendencies, maybe, but I noticed that a lot of folks in Ontario, certainly within a sort of under 30 campus-based anti-globalization scene, but I think, you know, beyond that, more much, much more generally, people had started using the term anti-oppression as a noun instead of just an adjective. So they'd say something like, my activism focuses on anti-oppression, or I think this group should work anti-oppression into its mandate more, or, you know, we shouldn't just go from summit to summit, we should stay in our own communities and focus on anti-oppression. And, you know, I hear people say these statements, and I don't disagree with the substance of those statements. But I think it belies a fundamental flaw in a lot of people's thinking, and I think in the movement's collective thinking, that oppression is something that's separate and that can be fought separately. And as Oscar has eloquently outlined, that would be like a big, big, long-term strategic mistake that's going to like destroy everything that we're trying to work for. So if we're going to have true solidarity, and if we're going to liberate ourselves from the many kinds of things that oppress us, we can't be thinking of anti-oppression as something separate. We can't think of how to organize certain anti-oppression activities or have anti-oppression groups or go to anti-oppression workshops and have that be a separate thing in our minds, in the ways we organize, or anything like that. So with an understanding of oppression as being something that's really about power, about, you know, abstract global systems of power like capitalism, patriarchy, colonization, white supremacy, but that aren't really abstract at all, like that inform the very concrete things that you know, make cops shoot people of color on a daily basis, or that, you know, cause Harris to cut welfare, leading to, like, all kinds of, like, death and destruction, to the G8, to everything else. And I've lost my place in my notes. Once we understand that to be the case, it becomes clear that organizing from an anti-oppression perspective means organizing seriously, right? It means, as OCAP has made the term famous, it means fighting to win, right? It means organizing as if we realize that people are affected by oppression in ways that kill them, in ways that destroy their lives, in ways that has a long, long history of destroying people's lives. And so it means that, like, we're highly, highly irresponsible if we don't organize in a way that we can be successful over the very long term, like over a time frame that's longer than all of our lives, that's longer than, you know, from now till the summer when the G8 meets, that's longer from one action to the next. So what that means in concrete terms is organizing strategically rather than tactically. And there's a whole bunch of questions, more than can be addressed here tonight, perhaps more that can be addressed, you know, in the short time frame of us as organizers being together here this weekend. Looking at those questions on a strategic level rather than a tactical level. There's four of those questions that I did want to touch in just quickly, and maybe we can develop that more in the discussion. But I wanted to touch on what it means when organizing from an anti-oppression perspective, that's organizing long-term, to talk about the concept of risk, to talk about privilege, to talk about violence and legality. So that's where my notes end. So the rest of this is ad-lib. But a lot of the debates, especially since the term diversity of tactics was coined, but before that as well, within, you know, the movements that I imagine to be represented within this room, have taken up these four questions on my friends are laughing at me in a very tactical manner, right? Like looking at when we plan this or that demo, when we fight this or that piece of legislation, when we support this or that other activist or this or that community that has been targeted, you know, what do these things mean in the very short term? And, you know, if we're gonna build a mass movement, if we're gonna, like, really be solidaritous and work with on an equal level, people who were taking much bigger risks than some people in this room are, that all falls apart, right? The whole idea of risking arrest, right? Like, many people risk arrest by getting up in the morning, by walking down the street, by driving while black, you know, et cetera, right? But at the same time, I've heard the argument made again and again that, I've heard two arguments made. On the one hand, that in order to include these people in our movement, we can't do risky actions, right? Like, we can't send Arab people to have a confrontational demo with the police in the wake of September 11th, for example. There's also the opposite argument, though, that sort of we have nothing to lose but our chains argument, which I've seen somehow bent and twisted into really oppressed people have everything to gain and nothing to lose, so therefore it's fine to be like randomly throwing rocks at cops just at every turn where, you know, there's 10 of us and 500 rowdy cops. And if we're building a movement long term, right, like if the risks are more than like this action or that action, and we're talking on a time frame where you know, there's several generations involved, people have got to be considering not only their immediate safety in a day-to-day sense, but their more long-term survival as well. It leads to the necessity of really planning our actions. It leads to the necessity of thinking how each of our actions and the level of risk of each of our actions fits into our long-term strategy and how it comes face-to-face with the long-term strategy and the people that are trying to stop us, right? Like, the changes of legislation, the build-up of CSIS files, et cetera, and on both sides of the diversity of tactics debate, I feel there's a lot of work to be done there in terms of incorporating this idea of risk into long-term thinking. The flip side of that is privilege, right? Like, who by virtue of whatever kind of privilege, class privilege, racial privilege, citizenship status within the Canadian state, et cetera, greatly affects the amount of violence that people have to face in our day-to-day lives. And thus greatly affects what it means to step outside that and take on extra risk. So I guess I won't say too more about that, or I'd be repeating myself on what I just said about risk. Maybe we can talk more about that in the discussion. In terms of violence, I feel that the discussions that have been had about violence, again, you know, making some assumptions about who's in the room, but within the movements that I assume and imagine to be represented in this room, the debate around violence has been almost completely brought back to a tactical level. And I've been baffled in some cases and angered in others to hear the argument made that, you know, diversity of tactics alienates women and people of color. You know, as I, you know, sit in a class every day, going like, "What? I'm a woman. I'm a person of color." I think it's a combination of an analytical mistake on the points that I just talked about in terms of risk and privilege. Like, I think that it's oftentimes well intentioned, of wanting to build an inclusive movement where women and people of color will be safe, but it's also at times pretty disingenuous when you look at who's making the argument, because it's an argument that's made from a purely tactical perspective, right? Like, if violence is defined as the violence of the demonstrators, like if it's framed as you know, the violence of one tactic versus another, rather than looking at a long-term strategy that includes a whole bunch of tactics, but a strategy that's actually capable of defending communities, including communities of color, including women in abusive situations, including like any oppressed group of people, and defend those communities in a winnable way, then shielding people of color, say for example, from violence becomes rather moot, right? Like if we're gonna preclude all the tactics that could stop the cops beating on black and Latino youth, thus the cops will keep beating on black and Latino youth, so they will still be subject to violence. So, you know, doesn't really like stop those folks from being subject to violence. Very similar to that comes the question of legality, which I think is very often conflated with the question of violence. It would be a whole other speech to address the difference between violence and property destruction. But a lot of what gets framed as violence in the debates within these circles about sort of violence versus nonviolence, diversity of tactics versus nonviolent organizing, the definitions we're using are the definitions of the states, right? They're the definition of the cops, the definition of the court system. And again, I think, you know, within a long-term strategy that's aiming to win, we need to have tactics within that strategy to pull out at times when they're appropriate, not to just use it random when we don't like it, and it's going to be fun. But, like, we need to have all the tactics open to us that are going to be effective. And adhering to the concept of legality, framing things in terms of whether they're legal or not, is a really dead end for the simple reason that when something's effective, it very quickly becomes illegal, right? Like, it's the system that we're trying to dismantle is not going to let us do the things that's letting us dismantle it. And, you know, without going into a debate that I'm sure, you know, will happen at another time, I think if we're serious about organizing from an anti-oppression perspective, and if we're serious about organizing in an effective way, in a solidaritous way, in a way that's going to get us anywhere, we really have to, like, stop using legality as a framework for whether a tactic is within our palette or within our arsenal or within our toolbox, right? Like, it can definitely inform and ought for sure to inform whether we use a tactic at a particular time, in a particular context, you know, looking at the notions of risk and of privilege and, you know, what's going to be effective and what's going to have what effect on which of the participants. But, you know, I could say this about violence as well, but using legality as a framework to categorically preclude this or that tactic is a dead end. So that's all I wanted to say for now. I'm looking forward to elaborating on these and hearing people's ideas on these concepts during the discussion period.